You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 164. Today's episode is about the largest event in the spirits and cocktail industry, really in the world, Tales of the Cocktail. We'll learn about its 20-year history, what the event is all about, and more. The last show was an interview I did with Jalen Ziles, founder of the Facebook group Where Black Nola Eats. I came away with both a new appreciation for the struggle of minority business owners and a list of terrific places to eat. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump in, let me talk about the people that make this show possible. Support comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection, the city's premier history museum located at 520 Royal Street in the heart of the French Quarter. They're always changing out exhibits, but current exhibits include the French Quarter life, people and places in the Vieux Carré. For more than 150 years, artists from all over the world have been using different mediums to capture the French Quarter, and this exhibition gathers 22 paintings from their own collection, but that aren't often out in the museum. It covers everything from the French Market to Preservation Hall, the people, the streets, the buildings. It's really a cool exhibit. It's free, like everything that they have at the Historic New Orleans Collection. This particular exhibit runs through August 28th, 2022, but they also have permanent exhibits. Go to hnoc.org/visit to plan your trip. We're going to get into tales in a minute, but the most frequent questions I get are about moving to New Orleans. And I've met a bunch of people already at Tales that are like, I love New Orleans. I live here half the time. I would love to live here. And if you are ready to make the move, you need a good realtor. And that's where Liz Wood comes in. Let Liz and her team over at Liz Wood Realty help you find the right place. Look, she can help whether you want to rent or purchase. And as my guest will tell you in a minute, New Orleans is a great city made up of neighborhoods, but it can be hard to figure out the right spot for you, for your family, for your situation. And Liz makes that process fun and easy. So head over to LizWoodRealty.com and make your dream of living in New Orleans a reality. While you're working with Liz, you're probably going to need financing, and that's where Tommy Manzella at Gulf Coast Mortgage comes in. Tommy helped us on a refi about a year ago, and it was as smooth as could be. We then immediately started looking at buying another house, which we backed off of, but we went through the process again. Tommy and his team were just great. Could not say more about it, and that's why I asked him to come on as a sponsor. There'll be links in the show notes, but it's Tommy Manzella at Gulf Coast Bank. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. If you like the podcast, the Facebook group, the work I'm doing, please consider becoming a monthly supporter. You can find out more at patreon.com/beyondbourbonst. We have perks at all levels, and if you join at the $10 level or higher, we'll mention you on an episode. Last but not least, I have a book, The Beyond Bourbon Street Insider's Guide to New Orleans, officially released on May 1st. You can find it online at major retailers like Amazon, Bookshop, Barnes & Noble. You can find it in New Orleans at the Garden District Bookshop, Octavia, Blue Cypress, the OW, which is a secondhand upscale furniture store located at 2850 Magazine, has it. And our partners over at the NOLA T-shirt Club, also on Magazine, you can go in person or you can buy online. And they have the only autographed copies right now. So if you order online, you can get an autographed copy. If you love the show, the podcast, New Orleans, please consider picking up a copy. For more on that book, check out episode 157 where we did a deep dive. And now with all that out of the way, and I appreciate the patience, let's get on to today's topic. As I mentioned, it's all about Tales of the Cocktail. To help us dive into Tales, I'm joined by one of its board members, a driving force in the cocktail and spirits industry, and himself an owner of several terrific businesses. Welcome to the show, Mr. Neil Bodenheimer. How are you?
I'm doing well, Mark. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining me in the middle of a crazy week like we were talking about.
Pretty intense week. I'm a little too old to stay out as late as I did last night, but here we are.
That's right. So we are recording this on a Wednesday morning, smack in the middle of Tales. And as we were talking about, and we'll get into, Tales is very much like Mardi Gras, right? I mean, it is so packed, you have to try to pace yourself.
Yeah, I mean, you have all the same pitfalls, too. So, I mean, you've got people that are visiting from all over the world, and they, we were just laughing about it before we started recording, but, like, I have to constantly tell Tales first-timers, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint,
yeah.
And, which is certainly out of the out of the phrase book for Mardi Gras as well.
It is, and so many events, right? And so I want to get into that, but what I want to do is introduce the listeners to you and to your businesses and what you've done, because I think that when we take that in, it really blends into Tails and so much of why you became a bigger part of Tails. But let's start a little bit with your story. You are a New Orleanian, right?
I am, and so I actually grew up right down the street from where you are.
Okay.
So I grew up in Broadmoor.
Okay.
And I went to Newman School as a kid,
mm-hmm.
And then I ended up going to University of Texas. For your listeners, I'm wearing a Texas hat right now. So
you got to be pretty excited about the Manning family tradition continuing at Newman and now Texas.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when I went to Newman, I had the pleasure of getting to play football with Coop and with Peyton. So it was it feels great that Arch is going to go to Texas.
Yeah,
and also Will Randall too. And
yes,
and Will's a great player, so it's going to be wonderful.
Yeah,
I know Will's dad and mom too.
Uh huh.
And so they couldn't have picked a better place to end up.
Yeah, yeah. It's also sort of a sign of our age, right? That now Cooper Manning's son is going off to college to play and continue the family tradition.
Thank you for reminding me, Mark.
Yeah. So you grew up here in the city, but I think it's fair to say you kind of cut your teeth in the bartending world in your time in New York, right?
Yeah. And so I moved to New York just after 9/11.
Mm.
I had been traveling before that, and I ended up on the Upper East Side. It was where my first apartment was. It was a friend of a friend of my cousin's who just was leaving an apartment and said, "Hey, if you need one, this is affordable, go here." And of course I had, a little bit of hospitality background.
Yeah.
I got, as this is like the most typical New Orleans story, but I got my first bar job at 18. And so, and back then, and this is another thing that will show our age, back then it was 18 to drink and not 21.
Right.
So from there, I kind of always, I was always drawn to the hospitality business, and I was lucky enough to go work for Ralph Brennan when I was 19 years old, and I was a host at the now gone Baco restaurant on Charter Street.
That's a great spot.
I'll just never forget getting to do Super Bowl the Super Bowl and working there and how exciting it was to get to see all of the celebrities and everything.
Sure.
I really fell in love with the business.
Yeah.
But, and so I would always default to it. So I moved to New York and I'm like, oh my God, I got to make money. I've got to pay for this apartment that costs too much money. And I started walking around and handing out some version of a really sad resume at that time. And I was able to get a job working for a company for Steve Hansen's company. It was called Be Our Guest at the time. And he eventually sold to Starwood. But I ended up kind of by fate going into a place on the Upper East Side, handing a resume, and they were looking for people. And I really cut my teeth up there in the business and as a server and then a bartender. And as fate would have it, they were one of the first companies to hire a corporate mixologist.
Hmm.
And so I was really fortunate to be on the Upper East Side at that moment because it was a place that's much like New Orleans, still had a tradition of some classic cocktails and more classic things. And so that was the first place where the corporate mixologist landed. And he's still a friend of mine to this day. His name's Evan Clem. He's certainly a mentor of mine. And, Evan brought me to Bimmelman's and to go see the work that Audrey Saunders was doing, and we would go around town, and he really turned the light on for me on this industry.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I kind of realized that I didn't want to be on the Upper East Side at age 24 and 25. I thought maybe I wanted to be downtown, and I moved downtown and ended up getting a job within the same company down in the Meatpacking District as it was just getting going. And that was a club job. Now I'm going to gloss over a few jobs that I had that I did not stay with, but so I ended up working in a Velvet Rope, celebrity, nightclub kind of setup. And it was great, but I was living like a vampire and working a few days a week and living certainly a very, very, very fun existence. And so from there, you know, I just remember I would get home at 7 a.m. So eventually, I just started to ask myself, like, do I really envision myself living like this? Mm-hmm. And so I ended up getting a job through a friend working for Danny Meyer. He'd just opened the Modern, and they realized that they wanted to tweak the bartenders behind the bar at the Modern. And so they brought in a group of folks, and I was in that group to come through and kind of like push it forward a little bit.
Sure.
And we had a ball. It was actually a few of my friends that I'd worked with at Atlantic Grill, and it was the year that the Modern opened and won Best New Restaurant.
Yeah.
But it was important for me because I really loved the business. I just didn't think that I could find a career in the business, a sustainable career in the business.
Sure.
And which is something that is still, I think it's better today, but I think the pandemic certainly has set us back in that, you know, how do you find a sustainable career in this business? And I think a lot of people, when everybody lost their job in this business,
right,
you know, a little over 2 years ago, that certainly brought up some questions about sustainability in this career.
Yeah.
But we can get into that.
Yeah, and
I'm gonna, at a later date. But
I'm gonna hit you about that a little bit when we get into tales. But what was the impetus for you to come back home?
So I was working. I was still working downtown in the club, and then I was also working for Danny Meyer. And then Danny Meyer kind of showed me that you can be a gracious team first, suppliers first, hospitality owner, and entrepreneur. And it really just made me see that I actually could build a career doing this. And so I was working on a version of Cure for the New York market. And I don't know how I would have gotten it off the ground, but I was worried, you know, I was calling real estate agents and banks and whoever would, you know, take my call. And most people really wouldn't.
Right.
Because it was New York and they were like, "What? This kid doesn't know what he's doing."
Right.
And to be honest, they were right. and so Katrina happened. My brother was working for the city of New Orleans. My sister worked for CNN. They were both here. And I think anybody that's from New Orleans during that time felt this pull to come back.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, you just knew that like the city wasn't going to rebuild itself without the people that really cared about it being here. And so within the year, I was, so if Katrina happened at the end of August of 05, I was back by the 1st of December of 06. So really just, I mean, I always round for easy numbers and say, you know, 07 is when I came back, the beginning of 07. But technically I came back for the holidays and I was like, and I was ready. And I got a job at the Della Chase.
Yeah.
And
great place.
Yeah. Great place. And I loved working there. And it was just, they just had such a great spirit selection and they cared about wine. And it was really the best place for me to land here because it just kind of hit a lot of the things that I needed to be happy in a hospitality business.
Well, I think one of the things you bring up is New York obviously was far ahead of New Orleans in sort of moving out of classic cocktails. But New Orleans is famous for these cocktails that were invented here or certainly popularized here. But we were a little slow to move towards sort of beyond that, right? Beyond the famous drinks here. And from my lens, so you come back relatively quickly. It feels like maybe that didn't feel like to you, but Open Cure, a great place, mentioned in my book, by the way, but on Ferret Street. When you opened that, really, Ferret was not the bustling street that it is now.
It was not.
I'm being generous. It was a great community there, but it was not, you know, and it had a lot of damage in Katrina.
I mean, it was flooded. It was totally flooded out. I mean, these buildings needed, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars just to get back into commerce.
Yeah. And you guys took this beautiful space. I don't know. Was it an old fire station? That's what it looks like.
So yes. So it actually is. So it is an old fire station.
You can tell by the rounded arch, like in the window there.
But so when we purchased it, it was an electrician shop, and there was, And then there was a law office upstairs.
Okay, so it's a beautiful space. I still think there's no sign, right? I don't think you have a
sign
on the door.
There is no sign,
right?
And honestly, for all of our for all of your New Orleans listeners, it was the last permit, and I was so over the permitting process. And back then, and this is exceptionally tongue in cheek, but I'm just going to say it. There was just no nighttime activity on the street.
Yeah.
And so we said, if you're not smart enough to see that the giant arch window with the bottles is the bar that you're trying to get to, maybe you're not smart enough to come in.
I knew your New York background, and I always took it as a little nod to New York, with the places without the signs. And I also, it always makes me think of Clancy's, a great neighborhood restaurant that's really hard to find. Mm-hmm. But when you find it, it's delicious. So Cure is that way. But Cure to me was, I'd be curious, from your perspective, of course, Cure was the first place I remember really in the city that really kind of took a bar program and took it away from what I think of as the classic cocktails in New Orleans, the Pimm's Cups and the Old Fashions and the French 75s and all those things, right? And really elevated fresh ingredients and just a really unique menu. And that culture you mentioned almost in passing of when you walk in Cure, even today, you feel that the servers, that the people working there feel a part of the team. It doesn't feel like you were walking in and walking up to a random bartender who has a job. It feels very welcoming to me. They're knowledgeable. They're proud of what you guys have created there. So I'm guessing that was intentional based on what you've said.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it was intentional. And I was a bartender, and I've got the partially torn rotator cuff to prove it. And I wanted to build a place that I wanted to work. Mm-hmm. This gets back to not knowing what I was doing, is that I had this misconception that I was going to be able to be the bartender, one of the bartenders at Cure, and be the owner, mm-hmm. and be the manager, and be in. I mean, at one point I thought I was going to be the bookkeeper too. And I mean, there's just it. I had to work in it to know what my job was really going to be.
Sure.
And so, I really built this as a place that I wanted to work. Mm-hmm. I built it as a place that I wanted to do. And it is still, no matter how many projects we do, it's still the most grounded part of me, because it's something that I envisioned for so long. And it's a very personal project for me.
It's a great space, super knowledgeable people there. I guess I would describe it as it's upscale for New Orleans, but it's not pretentious in any way. It's a great place to sit in the corner there and have a drink and a couple appetizers and catch up with people.
And I would say that we found that in maturity as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that it did take us a few years to find our footing and to figure out our identity, mm-hmm. and to figure out how we fit into New Orleans, what makes us a New Orleans bar, and which I think is common, we just needed to understand, initially the goal was to make a bar that felt like it could belong in any larger city. Mm-hmm. That was it. Cure had been planned for New York. Mm-hmm. And then after Katrina, when I came back down, I said, I really want to open this down here. And I talked to my business partner, Matthew Conkey, and I said, look, I think we just shouldn't dumb it down. I don't think it needs to be dumbed down for a different market. I think we just need to do what we would have done, mm-hmm. had it been somewhere else.
And it has that feel, definitely. I could see it in New York or some other big cities. And yeah. So from there, though, that wasn't enough. So you moved on and have done some other ventures. I promise we'll get to Tales, but I really think your kind of journey is interesting. I guess we'll mention, since it's right down the street, it wasn't the next one, I don't guess, but Val's.
Val's, yeah. So that's actually why I have a very raspy voice today, is because I went to a Del Maguey mezcal party that was at Val's last night. It was the first party we've had because we opened during COVID. It was our first Tales party, and it was wonderful. I am 100% biased, and I love Del Maguey, and I love mezcal, and certainly I love Val. So I was their target demographic.
So Val's, I'll give my impression and then ask for yours. Val's one opened during COVID, so not a good time, except that it was maybe a former gas station, I think, or a garage.
It was.
And so most of the space is outdoors.
Correct.
Which proved to be luck, I'll say.
I think that's an understatement.
You opened during COVID. There is a tiny indoor spot, and certainly the bar is inside, but you opened right in the heart of COVID. Most of the seating is outdoors. Over the couple of years now, you guys have done a great job providing some shade and cover and all of that, so that most days, even in the heat of New Orleans summers, it's pretty pleasant there. I would term it sort of a street Mexican food kind of place with a slightly more upscale vibe, and of course the great cocktail program to back it up.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty much there. I mean, I think for us, we were looking for ways to make the things that we liked casual, while still feeling good and stylish. I mean, we have, you know, I have three partners in the project. Matthew Conkey, who is my original partner at Cure, and Matthew is a designer and a builder. And so Matthew really had a vision for the property, and, you know, so much, you know, we're very lucky to have different talents. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, he was able to find the property. It took us 5 years to open. It was it was very hard to get that property, you know, developed.
It looks so different than it did.
Yeah. I mean, but it's crazy. And that's the way that Matthew thinks. He can look at that and see that. I could look at that and see a broken down garage.
Right. Right. Which is what it was for many, many years.
And yeah, absolutely. And then we've got, you know, Alfredo Nogueira, who's one of our partners, who's our chef partner. And Alfredo is just such a talented cook. And he loves Mexican cuisine, and he's spent so much of his time traveling to Mexico, and it was just something that he really wanted to do. And then our other partner, Turk Dietrich, you know, we looked at that location for so long. He was the longtime general manager at Cure and was one of our opening bartenders.
Okay.
And so it really is a really strong team of ours, and that's just, you know, that's just partnership in the team. I mean, there's so many people on our CureCo team and our Vals team that have been with us for a long time that make what we do possible. And, you know, certainly they make us look really good because they're so good at what they do and they're so professional.
It's a great spot. And it seems to me, and again, this is something I want to mention when we get to Tales, is your timing was unfortunate in the one sense of COVID. On the other sense, it was at a moment when people that wanted to get out of the house were only going to be able to eat outside. So you had that going for you. Before Katrina, we really had very little in the way of Mexican and Latin food. And there is definitely a subculture here now of a handful, maybe more than a handful of restaurants that kind of tap into that. And Val's is one of those. I think about a place like Barracuda, different style, but right. Cucuy's is another one.
Yeah.
Rosalita's. But really that influence probably happened because of Katrina and people coming to help and then staying and bringing their own culture in many ways, I think. The other thing it hit is mezcal and tequila really are on the rise. And you know, you guys, whether that was by design or intention or a little bit of luck or both, are positioned really well there for that kind of resurgence in those spirits.
You know, I will get to this. I think that there's always luck. I think there's, you know, you try and predict where things are going. So I told you it took us a long time to get it going. We have loved agave spirits for forever. We had a large collection at Cure before we opened Val's. We've actually thinned our selection. We've really refined it at Cure because Val's can have a more expansive selection.
Yeah.
And we actually held, for years we would hold bottles of mezcal
right.
at Cure and be like, and Turk and I would be like, okay, let's get this. We'll just hold it because we know that we're going to use this one day. And we did, and those bottles are still over at Val's now,
right?
Because we just knew it. I mean, at one point, it was thousands of dollars of mezcal that we were sitting on, dreaming of opening what would become Val's.
And you know, it obviously pairs well with the food. And now there is this real interest in mezcal.
Yeah, and I certainly hope that in New Orleans that it continues to grow. I mean, I think New Orleans is behind the market a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think that there is a tremendous interest in mezcal. Mm-hmm. I think New Orleans is certainly on it with tequila, and tequila is moving here at a very fast pace. And I think that that's true all over the country and all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we're a little slower on mezcal
mm-hmm.
than we are on tequila. And that's fine, because I think that, you know, I'll quote my wife. She says it tastes like smoky Band-Aids. And I'm like, look, I get it. I get that that is a hard flavor, but not every mezcal tastes like smoky Band-Aids.
Right.
They are all unique crafted distillates. And so some are better made than others.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, these are real artisans that are doing rustic quality spirits. And you just don't see that in a lot of places.
Yeah.
And so it's, you really have to appreciate the history, the technique, and the agaves that they use.
I was on to it. I knew it was coming around in New Orleans when Ashley Hansen from Hansen Snowblizz was at a special event, I think Boudin Bourbon and Beer, and was serving a snowball with mezcal in it,
mm-hmm.
Which was delicious and like this really incredible pairing. But I'm getting us off track. I want to talk about your book. I want to briefly talk about, you have two other properties. So let's talk about Cane and Table and Peychaud's and tell listeners a little bit about them. Because again, they're both really unique in their own ways.
So, and they are. And so Cane and Table is just turned 9.
Wow.
Last week. And we're going to do something for the 10-year. It's always been kind of a hard deal for us, because we opened during Tails initially.
Right.
And so, you know, we took over an existing business in the fall of 2012, and then we ran that business as we were getting our act together, and
mm-hmm.
and it was a bar called Pravda, and it was a Russian vodka right. and absinthe bar, and so we bought it from a friend, and then we spent probably 9 months pushing out flavored vodka, which was not what we were into. And just trying to figure out what we wanted to do, and we really ran it like a pop-up and said, look, mm-hmm. What would happen if we ran this pop-up and just to get our act together and decide, we just knew that it was the right property for what we wanted to do. You know, it really feels like you're in an old port town, whether you're in, you know, whether you're somewhere in Cuba
mm-hmm.
Or whether somewhere in the Caribbean. We just felt like it was the right space for what we were thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of our founding partners was really interested in tiki. Kirk Stopenal, another one of our partners at Cure, was really interested in old Cuban drinks,
mm-hmm.
and as am I. And so we said, like, what if we could like get into a little bit of the tiki stuff, but we really were focused on this kind of the emergence of tropical cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we got going, and we were, you know, we were lucky enough when we opened up. My friend Adam Biederman did a consulting project in the kitchen, and then over time we brought in our own chefs, and we've kind of evolved the program. And now our partner Alfredo Noguera, who we spoke about earlier, who is of Cuban descent, went in there and just was like, "No, I want to do my family's food," and it has been incredible. We also have a really great executive chef there, and his name is Mike Hampton, and Mike has cooked around town, and he used to own a restaurant in Florida, and so we have a really great kitchen team there. And so really we started off like wanting to run a bar with some food, and then because we had a restaurant license,
right?
And then over time we were like, well, why don't we just really make this into a restaurant? And so as Kirk really went down to Cane and Table and Alfredo went over to Cane and Table, like, we really said, you know, cocktails are great, but this is a restaurant and there's an amazing opportunity here. And we've been very lucky. It's been a very successful restaurant for us and a very successful project. And all the time I'll be talking to people around New Orleans, they're like, oh, I've never been to Cane and Table. I'm like, yeah, that's okay. And I mean, and you know, without getting into the pandemic too much, I mean, we probably 15% of our business over time has been local, and
uh-huh.
we do service mostly people that live downtown on the other side of Esplanade.
Right.
And so there are people, you know, that on our side, we both live on the other side of a canal, are, you know, they just don't come down to the back of the French Quarter that often.
Right.
But we knew that we loved it because we grew up here, and
right.
you know, when we wanted to go have a drink in the French Quarter, we didn't want to go in the tourist part,
right,
on the front side, we wanted to go where locals went on the backside.
Yeah.
And a little known fact is that that space used to be G&E Courtyard Grill.
Oh, really?
Which is where I had when I was younger, I had my first glass of wine at G&E Courtyard Grill. So it felt very full circle. Now, what that glass is shall forever remain a secret.
Right. I remember it as the Russian place, but I do remember Genie's. What I like, so from a customer perspective, I've watched Cane and Table grow from predominantly, I always saw it, rightly or wrongly, sort of as a mashup of Beach Bum Berry Latitude 29, very heavy tiki bar, great, and Manolito.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of really tiny, sort of Cuban influence, really small. They actually do have good food there, but it's really focused on their drinks. Mm-hmm. And Cane and Table seem to sort of blend the two.
Well, and so we predated both of them.
Right, right.
And now, to say that we predate Jeff Berry, it would be false. I mean, Jeff Berry is...
Sure,
but the property... Jeff and Anine are, you know, the most well-known tiki professionals, you know, tropical drink professionals in the universe.
Right.
So it's not, but we knew Jeff was coming in. Jeff's a friend and we knew he was going to do it. And so our partner at the time, he was very interested in tiki. And as I said, Kirk and I were less interested in tiki.
Right.
And so we said, look, Jeff is coming to town. Like, do you think that you're going to do tiki better than Jeff Berry?
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe we just need to find a nice balance between the stuff that we're interested in, the stuff that you're interested in, and let's merge it into something that's a little more cohesive and different.
Mm-hmm. And it hit that.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would say is, it is a place that when I step into makes me think about a little bit about Key West, and I don't mean the cheesy part of Key West. There's a part of me that steps in and thinks, if Ernest Hemingway came to New Orleans, this is where he would hang out. Like, it has that vibe to it. Very, I don't know how to describe it other than that, but it feels to me like that.
It has a very relaxed tropical vibe.
I mean, obviously the French Quarter is unique, but it does, when you step through those doors, there's a different feeling yet again.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that gets to, again, your partners and the, you know, the design and the space.
And look, I think that building's 200 years old. It's like running a movie set.
Right.
Right. I mean, like, sometimes things work, sometimes they don't work. It is. But when the lights go down at night, I mean, it's pure magic.
Yeah.
And you know, beyond that, I also think that what really I love about Cane and Table is that, you know, the French Quarter has always been a place that has a lot of different people. And our teams are wonderful. But they are not, you know, they're not like the plainest, most conforming people in the world. And so I really think that that is another thing about Cane and Table that is my favorite part, is that our team is uniquely New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
and they come in all shapes and sizes. And it is definitely something that they're very professional. But at the same time, like, you might walk in and be like, where am I?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a great vibe. So if you're a local and you're listening and you haven't been to the French Quarter often or to that side of the French Quarter, it's definitely worth checking out. And again, we mentioned it almost in passing, but it has morphed, in my point of view, from a great cocktail bar to a great restaurant with a great cocktail bar.
We may or may not be working on a secret project upstairs.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Nice. The food is great. And it really has evolved over the years. So I promise we're going to get details. But so you have two other things, Pay shows.
So Pay shows came during the pandemic. My friends and partners who are based in Nashville, who are both from Louisiana, purchased the building. They had a tenant. The tenant just picked up and left during the height of the pandemic. And they said, do you want to come run this bar in the French Quarter? And I said, no. Because French Quarter was dead. And then as we started looking at the research at the, you know, at the property.
And the history,
yeah. I mean, it really captured my imagination. And we started working on it. And it has been, it's been a wonderful project. It's very straightforward, classic New Orleans bar, small room, wonderful patio out back.
Yeah.
Classic New Orleans drinks. Like, it is I mean, that's it. We're really lucky. We're two doors down from Will and the Way, mm-hmm. on Toulouse, and Toulouse Theater's in the next block. But we are literally two doors off of Bourbon, and you wouldn't know it. It's
completely different feel.
It's an oasis. So if you're ever on Bourbon Street, God help you, and you realize that you want to get off quickly, we are one of those spots. I would also say French 75 mm-hmm. is another great place off of mm-hmm. Bourbon if you need to just bail.
It's also a good example. Again, the podcast is called Beyond Bourbon Street for a reason. You can take this half step, half block detour and have a completely different experience. Some of the places we've mentioned, Cane and Table and Manolito and Latitude 29, but right, Peixot's just steps off and all of a sudden you're in this different world. Mm-hmm. Right, much more peaceful, laid back.
And you would think that the bar has been there for a long time. I mean, the building has been there.
Right.
So it was Antoine Amédée Peixot, who was the apothecary. He was a pharmacist who made the patent medicine that would become Peixot's Bitters.
Right.
And so it's really, for a cocktail nerd like me, a unique property. And we were lucky that Sazerac Company let us use the trademark for Peixot's.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so... for us, we felt a responsibility to create a very classic New Orleans bar. It is, you know, very nice bar, but it is also no frills in the way that a New Orleans classic bar should be.
It's very different than Cure, right? So we've come full circle from that, and very different from Cane and Table as well.
Well, and I also think that speaks as well to maturity and what you want in different stages mm-hmm. of your life,
mm-hmm.
right? And so... for me and for our opening team there, we said, like, let's take personal pursuits out and what is right for this property and what is right for New Orleans and what is the appropriate way to respect where we are. And we felt Peixot's was that.
And I love it. I think Peixot's, he was either the first licensed pharmacist in Louisiana or possibly in the whole of the United States. And of course, the Pharmacy Museum is right down the street, mm-hmm. not far from there as well. So you can go, great little museum was his place, so you could do that, and then you can go have a drink at Peixot's. So that's great.
And we were really lucky. I don't know how this happened, but we made Esquire's Best Bars list this year. Which, right. I mean, it's been a hard year. You know, you don't want to open a new business in the French Quarter during a pandemic, and we were really excited for that. And the team has worked really hard through some really trying times, and particularly in the French Quarter. I mean, the French Quarter is more affected than any other neighborhood.
Yeah, hardest hit, probably slowest to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we're and I told you 45 minutes. We're 38 minutes in. Your voice is holding up okay.
I think it's getting stronger.
Yeah, I do too. you got a lot of projects going on, but one of those is a book. So let's talk about your book a little bit.
So, Cure, New Orleans Drinks and How to Mix Them, and that's a nod to Stanley Clisby Arthur's 1937 book.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just wanted, number one, to talk about classic New Orleans cocktails. Number two, we wanted to talk about Cure and its journey. And number three, we really just wanted to talk about New Orleans and what makes New Orleans unique. And so I mean, I don't have to tell you that's who I am. I'm a New Orleanian. I love this town and I love its drinks culture and I love its people. And I love its restaurants. And it was something that I really wanted to do. And I never thought that I would be an author, much less. Thankfully, I'm a co-author, or else it really never would have happened.
I know the feeling.
And my co-author, Emily Timberlake, is like the best. And frankly, when we were writing the book through the pandemic, those weekly Zooms that we had really like kept me sane.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of my most, I can't imagine writing this book without a co-author, and I cannot imagine getting to the pandemic without writing the book.
Mm. Yeah. So I kind of had a similar experience. I wrote the book, was almost done before COVID. And then the editors said, we have to stop because businesses are closing. And mm-hmm. so then I rewrote the book and completely changed the style of the book and decided to make it neighborhood focused.
Mm-hmm.
And but like you, I think I had a lens that I wanted to share New Orleans. I didn't want it to be just a travel guide. I wanted it to be sort of my lens of New Orleans and a description and to take you along. And I feel like in the same way, that's what you've done through your lens of cocktails, right?
Certainly, that's what I've been trying to do. And it's also, you know, Cure is now almost 13 and a half years old, right? And we've produced a lot of great cocktails there, and mm-hmm. we don't go back to them that often. And we really felt like if we didn't write them down and we didn't put them out there, that that people might forget that they exist. And so, and it was as much about telling the story of New Orleans, but it was also about preserving the cocktails that we had in the work that we had done over 13 years. And so it really is, it's been wild.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. And what I realized is that as fond as I am of the old work that we did at Cure, it makes me appreciate our new work even more. And I see how far we've come mm-hmm. and I see how good we've gotten at our work mm-hmm. over the years. And so it has been a fascinating experience for me. And I really like the book, but then again, you know, I better like the book. I spent that much time doing it. So, you know, you can do pre-sale for the book at Garden District Books, and, you know, but we're going to work with all booksellers locally, and certainly Octavia Books,
yep.
who runs the bookstore downstairs at Tales. Yep. It's a great partner for us too.
Yeah.
And we're just excited. We're excited to go spread the gospel of New Orleans cocktails. And we're going to go spread it around the country and around the world, because I believe that people need to know about our canon of drinks.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. And we'll certainly put links to it so people can pre-order and all of that stuff. I thought we'd do 45 minutes, and we've done 45 minutes about that. But I think that the contributions of you and your partners really set the kind of tone about what Tales is about. So I want to transition some and talk about. So here we are at Tales of the Cocktail, celebrating its 20th year. This is going to be a hard question to ask you to simplify, but in a nutshell, what is Tales of the Cocktail for someone that has no idea? How would you describe Tales?
I mean, this is going to be a huge understatement, and I'm going to undersell what this is. I mean, this is the most... is just a unique event. It can't be 100% put into words. Mm-hmm. But New Orleans is lucky to have Tales of the Cocktail. That's why we fought so hard to save it, mm-hmm. is that it is the premier cocktail festival and convention in the world. Hands down. I mean, people come from everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, when we were digital, this little New Orleans nonprofit had 106 different countries tune into our education when we were fully digital. It's insane. Yeah. I mean, if you would have asked me whether our global reach was that large, I would have told you that you were crazy. But that's something that we've realized over the years. And I would say, and this is, you know, I can say this from one New Orleanian to another, that New Orleans is the spiritual home of the cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be the home of the cocktail, but it's definitely the spiritual home. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is one of the best ways for us to show people who we are in New Orleans, what we do. But it also attracts talent to this market.
Mm-hmm.
And because we have 15,000 attendees.
Right.
I mean, and for every $1 that a sponsor spends with us, they spend about $13 to $15 in the community. I mean, it's a huge impact at a time where no one would be coming right. in the third week or the fourth week of July. It's like, I mean, I hate to tell anybody that lives here, like, no one's coming at that time. It is not our best foot forward.
No.
It's hot. It's rainy.
Yeah. But it is, I wonder what the total economic impact is, but, and I was at an event last night at Isaac Toops Meadery, and, you know, the impact of Tales locally is that you're having these events where you're buying out these restaurants, you know, and venues that would be having a tough time, right? We're a month or two away from Culinary, which is sort of a way to try to spark locals to get out and eat during a slow time. But lots of places around the city are hosting events. And that's one of the things about Tales, right? We're at the Ritz-Carlton, the sort of home base of it. But I don't know how many different venues, dozens and dozens and dozens of venues are hosting events.
I mean, it's a very large festival.
Yeah.
And so, there are night parties, there are dinners, there are happy hours. There's just so much. I mean, I would recommend any of your listeners go to talesofthecocktail.org and mm-hmm. just take a look at the schedule and just take it in. I mean, it is a world-class event. and it happens here. And the reason why most people don't know that much about it is because we are primarily trade focused.
Yeah.
Right. But this is a, in my opinion, a crown jewel of New Orleans. And it is, it does amazing things to spread, you know, just to spread people's love for New Orleans around the world. You know, certainly I hope anybody that's listening takes a sec, finds ways that they can engage with Tales, whether it's going to a dinner, whether it's, you know, coming by the Ritz, taking a look at our education, or going to a tasting room or whatever. I just think that it's such an important thing, and so many people don't know about it or don't know how to engage with it.
Right.
Because it's not 100% enthusiast focused. It's yeah. professional level education.
Yeah, I think that's one of the challenges, right? It is very much focused inward on the industry, although worldwide, like you said. Yep. There were people sitting next to me last night from three different countries, you know, of the six of us sitting close by. And I think media focused in terms of it's a great opportunity to sort of look at trends and get education as part of the media about what's going on and get to know some of the sort of up and comers and the established people in the industry. But there are opportunities for people that are just enthusiasts. There are dinners, there are special events. The Sazerac 100%. Has had some open events this week that have been terrific.
Yeah, I mean the Sazerac House has been you know, a great venue.
Yeah.
I mean, so the Sazerac House wasn't open when we did our last Tales. It's been almost 3 years.
Right.
Because we did it in 2019, and then obviously we know what happened in 2020.
Right.
2021 didn't happen last year, so it really had been almost 3 full years since we had executed this event, which is a very large event.
Yeah.
And we were very grateful that we were able to make it through the pandemic without going under.
That's probably a good segue to step back. This is the 20th year of Tales. Kind of went through a transition, figuring out of itself, and underwent a leadership change, fresh new board. You were part of that board, and all of that happened really right before Katrina, or 2 years before Katrina, maybe. Right? I'm sorry, before COVID.
Before COVID, yes.
Right.
So we took over in 2018, and it was a hard time. It was an event that was in crisis, and we've. I think successfully guided it out of that period, and then we went straight into COVID, and like anybody with any business, we were affected as well. We gather people, we convene people, so not really a pandemic friendly business.
Right.
You know, we had to use the most overused word, pivot. We had to pivot and try and figure out how to keep our organization afloat, and we have done that mercifully. And now I'm just very grateful that we can gather everybody for the 20th year of Tales of the Cocktail.
Yeah, here. I was really, I think doing it virtually, you guys did the best you could, but so much of Tales of the Cocktail is the community. You know, some of the things, and I'd like to get your input on this, from my lens, that shift in 2018, it felt like there was a recognition that there were gaps in talking about gender equality and some of the challenges in the service industry as a whole. And you were sort of also at that Me Too moment.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the agenda, and again, you're right. To me, when you go to the Tales of the Cocktail website, it's almost overwhelming because it's so, not only do you have the events, but like, let's set that aside for a moment. The education programs that go everything from sustainability to being inclusive,
yeah.
You know, all you guys have just taken it and really expanded the breadth of it, in my opinion.
Well, and so there are a few reasons why, right? Our mission is to educate, advance, and support the global spirits industry. And so the global spirits industry is a big place. There, as you may or may not know, there are not that many barriers to entry to get into hospitality work. So we're very representative of, you know, our entire domestic society, but also globally, we're very representative. And so it's a huge, huge community,
mm-hmm.
and with the same problems that we have in the rest of the world. And so these are ways that we as a community can kind of talk through the things that are on our minds. You know, I went to an amazing Indigenous Voices seminar yesterday. It was really enlightening for me personally. And it was just so wonderful to see that we can have these kind of conversations under our umbrella. Mm-hmm. And I know that these conversations will make our world a better place and our industry a better place. And so I feel very grateful that I get to be a part of presenting those.
Yeah, and it feels like that has become much more expansive.
Well, it is. Yeah. And so to get back to your original question, we basically took our education program and put it into committees. And mm-hmm. we used to have an education director, mm-hmm. and we realized that we wanted to kind of democratize the process. So mm-hmm. we put together co-chairs through three different tracks. And our okay. three different tracks, which you can see on the schedule, mm-hmm. are Beyond the Bar, which health, wellness, social, mm-hmm. and then business, which would be professional level business education for those that are in bar ownership or want to be in bar ownership, or you know, may work for a brand and want to sharpen their skills. And then culture. And culture is that very traditional tales seminars, mm-hmm. which is history of drinks,
right.
you know, education on distillate. I mean, it could be any number of things, but it is very much the culture of cocktails, spirits, and that's kind of how it breaks down.
Yeah. And we should also mention that there's competitions, there's events. Many years ago now, one of my early guests was Abigail Gulla.
Oh, yeah. I love Abigail.
The year she won the best cocktail, I forget what the actual award is, best cocktail or best bartender in North America, maybe. Mm-hmm. But it does feel like, as you look at the program, that education part, those other two segments particularly have gotten much larger. But it's also an opportunity, again, for the industry to come together and kind of share ideas.
It is. And you know, we have to evaluate constantly. And, mm-hmm. and we're very lucky that we have a metric mm-hmm. to evaluate, and that's ticket sales.
Yeah.
And so if these are events that sell really well, we know that there's heavy interest in it. And if there are events that don't, then we have to evaluate that.
Yeah.
And so there is an economic and analytical part of this as well, where we say, look, this is what people presented to us. So people present seminars, they basically submit seminars.
Pitch, yeah.
And then our committees go through them and vet them mm-hmm. and decide what we think is the most interesting education that we can present. And so sometimes we get it right. A lot of times we do.
Right.
And sometimes something people just aren't interested in.
Yeah.
And we find that out pretty darn quickly.
I think it's also interesting that it's a, you know, you have people from all facets of the industry come, and it's a big commitment. You know, I was sitting mm-hmm. next to a bartender last night from Austin, and it's a big commitment to travel, to take the time, right? Depending on where you are in your organization, you know, you're giving up income to come, right?
Well, I mean, you're giving up income, you're spending money. You have to really want professional development and networking, mm-hmm. right? And I think that there are people around the globe who do. And I mean, obviously, clearly, right? Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I've had a few New Orleans hospitality members be like, hey, I can't get a ticket. And you're like, well, yeah, you really, there are people from all over the world that are flying in that have to plan way before you to get a ticket because they're not coming all this way to not do the stuff they want.
Yeah.
So when you decide a week out that you want to go to a few seminars and a few parties, like, you're late.
Yep. And I can attest to that as a New Orleans, part of the New Orleans media. You look up and go, oh, Tales is next week. And then, mm-hmm. you know, your decisions become easy because things have been crossed off.
Mm-hmm.
But I really, like, you get that feel that people are investing in their time and they're giving up income to come. And they're, right, they're coming from all over the world. And so the people that I run into and talk to about their experience with Tales, it's this real sub-demographic of, like, mm-hmm. again, they're investing in themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe their company or their business is investing in them. But it's not just the big brands. It's lots of individuals who say, this is my personal development opportunity. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, getting back to where you started, Neil, it is the premier event in the world, really, for mm-hmm. folks that want to better themselves, get up on trends, make connections, all of those things. That's why I think you see a bartender giving up several nights of work and then laying out money to come to the city for this event, not only to have a good time, obviously, but
I mean, I think that's spot on.
Yeah.
And so I also want to leave you with this, which is a really interesting thing that I thought of the other day. So much of what happens, so much of the cutting edge of what happens in the spirits business and in the cocktail business, and which has grown so rapidly, it happens here. for every New Orleanian, like the most cutting edge things that you're going to see around the world for the next year. They all happen here this week.
That's a great point.
And then they will be disseminated throughout the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, I mean, being born and raised in New Orleans, not a lot of things that are cutting edge here. That are spread across
Fair
the
point.
World. Yeah. And it's, I think it's something that we should be really proud of.
Yeah. And again, kind of back full circle, the rise of tequila and mezcal. You see that in the events here this week.
Certainly.
I'm a big bourbon drinker, but you read the industry reports. If the bourbon community is worried about anything, it's the rise of mezcal and tequila. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there's plenty to go around in the world, but...
Well, I mean, I would argue that there's not plenty to go around in the world because I think that there are industries that have inherent problems. Mm-hmm. I think tequila probably as an agricultural product is going to have trouble keeping up.
Sure.
With the scaling that they've seen, just it takes 8 to 10 years, you know, particularly mm-hmm. for tequila, it takes 8 to 10 years to grow a full Blue Weber agave.
Mm-hmm.
And there are companies that try and shortcut that with different technology, but it affects the final product. And
sure.
So I think that just like any industry, I mean, bourbon has had to catch up with demand, and you see that there are a lot more labels today and a lot more production. And certainly tequila is trying to keep up with demand and you know, we'll see what's next and who has to keep up with demand next.
Yeah. And I sort of meant, like, I don't think bourbon needs to worry is my point. Mm-hmm. But I do think right now mezcal and tequila are where bourbon mm-hmm. was, 8-10 years ago, all of a sudden becomes popular again. You get all these different expressions, mm-hmm. but you got to come up with the resources.
That's right.
But it is interesting, as I looked at the menu of events at Tails, you can see these trends, just to your point, right? You see these trends coming up, and this, I hadn't really thought about it, like you said, this is sort of the focus here.
Well, you also see where these multinational companies are putting their resources, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And so if you really want to know what's coming down the pipe, what they're interested in, what they think the future is going to be, you look at where they're spending their sponsorship dollars. You look at what they're trying to get people interested in.
I thought it was interesting. Again, you mentioned the Sazerac House earlier. They had a whole, either they did or they're about to, I can't remember which night, it's blending together, a whole night focused on mezcal and agave, and mm-hmm. right? And that's really saying something when you think about a company whose foundation, again, is back in bourbon, mm-hmm. spending an entire evening essentially dedicated to, let's talk about this other spirit and where we want to be positioned
in
the world.
And look, I think Sazerac and the Gold Ring family should be commended. I mean, they have built an amazing company, a worldwide company. And they are not, I know we think of them as just a bourbon company because their bourbon and whiskey portfolio is so strong and so coveted, but they are a much larger company than that.
Mm-hmm.
And with significantly more diverse interests than just whiskey. They have a few amazing gins. They have, you know, amazing agave spirits, you know, some great rums, like some great cordials. So they're, it really, in, you know, and I hate to just give one supplier,
right,
you know, a little attention here, but they are a New Orleans family,
right,
and you know, a very important and philanthropic New Orleans family. And so I really, it's very impressive, their reach as a company, their growth as a company. And I think every New Orleanian should be proud that the Golden Ring family lives in New Orleans.
Yeah. I just think it's interesting where, again, your point of where they choose to highlight. But again, there's plenty brands represented here, plenty of different focuses. Again, it really is sort of a cutting edge. You come here, again, as part of the media and as a consumer, you come and you can really get sort of some foresight into where the industry's going, because mm-hmm. these 15,000 people are here to learn and mm-hmm. to take ideas, and they bring them back to their parts of the world and their restaurants, their bars, their programs, right?
Yeah.
And that's sort of what I wanted to get across with Tales of the Cocktail, because I do think it's off the consumer radar, because there's some events, but again, it is not designed as an outwardly facing festival.
Well, and we have to figure out ways that we can better engage with consumers, mm-hmm. and particularly with New Orleans consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's this week, maybe it's not this week, but we definitely want people to understand who we are, what we do, and the work that the foundation does. I mean, we haven't even gotten into the work. I mean, we're a nonprofit,
right?
And we take in money to then turn around and fund grants. So this is, you know, this is what we do. This is the economic engine that it takes for us to then turn around and do our giving.
Yeah.
And so we haven't been able to do, you know, hardly any giving over the past few years, and we're excited to have the opportunity to make some contributions back into society now.
And you also see the brands that come in sponsor community days as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah.
I think Campari had a day.
I will say, and this probably won't come through enough, but for anybody listening, Pig and Punch, which is a party that we end Tales with, mm-hmm. is a charity event that is on Frenchman Street. It is Josh and his whole team from San Francisco do an amazing job organizing it. And they raise money for KIPP, mm-hmm. for KIPP schools. I mean, yeah. The money goes right back into the community. And it is a perfect thing for anybody in the city. You can buy a ticket and you can go
yeah.
and have a blast and do some good.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good way to end it. It's so expansive. I know we spent a lot of time about all of the work you've done, but I think that you are not only are you super engaged in Tales, obviously, but I think there are others like you in this community that in their own parts of the world are doing the same kinds of things, right? And that's why I think it's so important for people to hear when you walk into a bar, you walk into a restaurant, there's so much behind that. Mm-hmm. And so much of that comes from Tales in many respects.
Yeah. And we were talking about this earlier. I mean, I met my business partner, Kirk, at Tales. And it's made so many amazing impacts on people's lives. You hear about marriages, you hear about partnerships. Uh-huh. I mean, new jobs. This is where it all happens. And
yeah.
it's very exciting for me. I loved the organization before and I love it now. And I feel very fortunate that it still exists and it's thriving and that it's here in New Orleans.
And I'm excited for the 20th anniversary. It's in person. It has, you know, obviously we're sitting here on a Wednesday morning. It's off to a great start. It certainly appears that many people have come back.
Yes.
Every event I've been to has been packed.
We had more people come back than we thought would come back.
Yeah, people are excited.
Yeah, really excited. The energy is fantastic this year. And we think it's going to be great next year as Tales turns 21. Right. Which is significant. And so we're really excited for the future. I think we're also just really grateful for the present.
Mm.
It's been a hard few years for everybody.
Yeah.
And to be able to convene everybody and to remind them that we're part of something bigger
yeah.
is really important.
I appreciate this. I know it's early. I know you have a lot of commitments. You've taken time in the middle of Tales to do this. I just want to say thank you for that.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
This is great.
Thank you for being part of a big part of continuing Tales and expanding it. We'll put links in the show notes to Tales, but also to be able to pre-order and find out about your book, your businesses. You see now my voice is going.
Wait, hold on. Before
yeah.
you close, I'm going to throw a wrinkle in here. Okay, I'm gonna go interviewer for a minute.
Go ahead.
All right, Mark, what's your favorite cocktail?
My gosh. So my go-to is an old-fashioned, I would say, but...
Bourbon, rye, or rum?
Rye.
Okay.
Yeah.
Strong order. I like
yeah,
it.
I really like rye. And this is going to sound completely... I don't know. It's going to sound like I'm playing to my audience, but I really like to go to Cure and just ask for a drink, period. Like,
I mean,
walk in and say to the bartender, because the menu's changing all the time. You guys mm-hmm. have favorites and obviously some things that are always on the menu. But I like to go in to a place like here with a knowledgeable bartender and say, make me something.
Yeah, and look, a bartender's going to ask you questions.
What do you like? What do you like? Flavors?
Yeah, what are you into? Do you yeah. And they can make some really great things, but that is it's a level of trust, right?
Yep.
And we had to earn that trust with you, and I would say for anybody, you go into a bar, and if you feel like they're doing a good job and they really care about what they're doing, then I think that is totally appropriate to say, you know, this is what I like, this is what I'm really interested in. Like, you have anything that you want to make me that's in that vein, and you might be surprised the drink that you that comes out that you really like. And but I would also tell you that, and I think I speak for every bartender and bar owner here, is that if that you don't like that drink, you have to say you don't like that drink.
Right.
And I know it's hard because you're going to feel like you're offending somebody. But when I used to tend bar, if I made somebody a drink that was off menu, I would put it in front of them and I would say, you need to tell me if you like this or not. And if you don't like it, I can assure you that you're not going to hurt my feelings.
Right.
And because the last thing that any bar owner, bartender, or anybody wants when you're in a bar or restaurant is for you to eat something or drink something that you don't like.
Sure.
That's not the way the business works. No one wants to bring you to their business and give you stuff you don't like.
But I think that comes back to the questions. And Abigail Gullah was the one that sort of first turned me on to trusting a bartender and, you know, asking or being asked a couple questions. So again, I am an old-fashioned drinker. I like rye particularly, but there's something about going into a place like Cure, especially if it's a place that you go to regularly, maybe know the bartenders or trust them. Three or four questions, right? Salty, sweet, sour. What are the flavors? What do you not like?
Yeah.
Usually enough to go, right? And what I love about that is then you get to kind of put your hands in their hands and the, again, coming back to tales, the exploration, right? Mm-hmm. To me, the best bartenders are the ones that love to be creative. Mm-hmm. And they're slinging the same old drinks night after night after night after mm-hmm. night, right? And when you come in and say, make me something different. So that would be my second favorite drink, is the unknown, walking into mm-hmm. and just saying, make me something and let me see what it is. I just think, because then you get the creativity.
I love it both ways.
Yeah.
You know, I love the classics and I love a well-made classic as much as anything in the world. But if I trust what someone's doing and I trust that they know what they're doing and they can show refinement, I would be happy to be in their hands.
Last night, the dinner I went to was a collaboration with Dickel and Toop. It was hosted mm-hmm. at Toop's. And
I mean, Isaac's a great host.
Yeah.
Isaac and Amanda, whoa, they are like...
Terrific restaurant.
Yeah, an incredible restaurant and just like the most charismatic, hospitality-driven couple that I've ever met.
They're on my list to get on the show, have been for a long time.
They're both pretty shy, so look out.
Yes, I'm aware of that, having been in the restaurant when they are there. They like to kind of stay in the back a little bit. But what I was going to say is... The cocktails, so one of the cocktails, I don't think it was the Leopold. It wasn't their rye. It was a Dickel.
It wasn't the three-chamber Leopold.
They did one with that, with a pecan liqueur in it, mm-hmm. and they called it a pawpaw vinegar, which was amazing. But what getting back to the point of putting yourself in someone's hands, one of the was I think it might have even been Dickel bottled in bond, but they did some sort of essence of apple and it had a cucumber flavor to it too. I don't like cucumbers, but I'm at this event, right? And I'm going to try everything put in front of me. It was amazing. It wasn't overpowering. And I would never, ever order this drink if I walked in and saw a cucumber in a drink. And it was arguably the best drink of the night.
Yeah, know? I mean, I actually had that experience last night at the Val's pop-up that there were a few different bars. There was Candelaria, it's in Paris, Leyenda and from Brooklyn, Limantour from Mexico City, and then Nomad. And so I had a drink from Limantour and it was like, do you want it? And I looked at it and it had a big piece of pineapple in it, and it was an Al Pastor influenced drink, and I really don't like pineapple. It's not an allergy or anything. I just don't like it. You know, I don't like the like tenderizing effect that pineapple does. I mean, anybody that uses it as a marinade, know, it's like an incredible marinade because it just breaks things down. I don't like how it breaks my tongue down. It's just not pleasing for me. And I saw it and I was like, ugh, I got to be polite and drink this drink. This amazing bartender from one of the best bars in the world just made me this drink. I need to drink it. And I drank it and I was like, hey, that's pretty good.
Totally how I felt last night with the cucumber. So with that, again, I've taken more of your time than I asked for, so I appreciate that. We'll put links again to the book, to the properties, but also to Tales of the Cocktail. Again, I can't thank you enough. I can't thank the staff at Tales. They've been wonderful.
Thank you, Mark.
It's such a good experience. My hope today as you're listening is that if you're in the industry, that you consider coming, that you find out about the programs. If you're not in the industry, that you take a look at the website and see the ways you can interact, but also the next time you go into a bar or a restaurant, that you think about the impact and maybe ask, you know, have they ever been to Tales? So with that, again, thanks to all my sponsors. Thanks to all of you who have bought my book. I look forward to Neil's book. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to the girls to close us out.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.